today I can see. I don't need it to be there today. Oh, my volunteer doing so good job. I just watch them. Oh my God. I can sit back. Before I have to do everything, I'm in front. This time I sit behind and see everybody. I can sit back. Before I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I'm laid back, see, watching everybody doing, and then I catch myself. Why I have to concentrate and make a bad speech today? It's like bothering me. Let go. So, I mean, it's good I make bad speech, and then my volunteer doing good job. No, push them. This, so I see myself.
Watch.
Did you say that? Gio would say
self,
that.
Very strong self.
So I mean, I think this meditation helped me to catch myself doing that.
Yeah, to be a little more detached and see yourself more objectively. Yeah.
Because I see her very talented in meditation. I say, what else is more important? But I think she has got a habit.
Yeah.
A habit that she has to be a front line. And now, so she has trouble to let her volunteer take over. Make her sick, physically sick already. So she's learning how to let it go.
Well, she is talented in meditation. And so now she can see these habits and let go of them. Yeah.
I kind of like this.
Yeah. Mm.
So what are Mamabhudra and Dzogchen, and what stage of samatha might these practices be useful?
Can you repeat his question?
Yeah, the question is, what are Mahamudra and Dzogchen? And at what stage in samatha could you be able to practice those? So, Mahamudra is the meditation on the mind itself. And Kagyu sect of Tibetan Buddhism, this is like their sort of preeminent approach to practice. And it is systematic, and there are manuals for how teachers can guide students in the practice of Mahamudra. And it's a very elegant practice. It involves creating a kind of fusion of attention and awareness so that you have the full analytical power of attention surveying the observational power of awareness. It's a really good combination. And the object is your own mind. And what you do is you seek to understand the nature of your own mind. And an important thing is that sometimes your mind is very active, producing a lot of objects, dhammas, that you objects of consciousness, and other times it's more still, it's more quiet. And you observe the relationship of the mind that's active with the mind that's still, and this leads you to understand the empty nature of these mind-created dhammas. And you actually see that the dharmas, that the mental objects are of the nature of mind itself. And then, in the next step, you see that the mind itself is equally empty. That it is of the same nature as the objects in the mind. So that's a very, very brief, cursory description of the Mahamudra practice. But it is a very, very powerful practice. Dzogchen is essentially the same practice, but without the same sort of detailed direction and without the sort of formal structure for guiding students. And it's basically the same process, but it's taught through what are called the pointing out instructions, which is kind of like guided meditation. And it's actually a very good way to teach meditation. It's a very good way to teach Dzogchen, Mahamudra, except that you really do need to have a pretty advanced state of samatha to have any success with it at all. If you don't have that degree of samatha, then it just kind of goes right past you. The level you can practice, you see, in the 10 stages of samatha, you can practice it. Some people might be able to practice it as early as the seventh stage. That's where you've already achieved a stable, exclusive focus of attention and powerful mindfulness. And what you're working towards is achieving effortlessness. So it's a little bit difficult to do this practice in stage seven because you do have to be making this ongoing effort and maintaining this ongoing vigilance to sustain the quality of your samatha. But it can be done. When you get to stage eight, your attentional stability and your mindfulness are effortlessly sustained. And so it's for that reason it's easier to practice Mahamudra at that stage. But at that stage also, the process of pacification of the senses is taking place, and so you're having all kinds of weird sensations, itching, burning, chills, you know, hot flashes, creepy crawly feelings like pressure on your head, all sorts of strange things happening. Your mind is becoming unified enough so that a lot of energy is coming available, but it's not yet unified enough that energy can flow freely, so you have all these feelings of chi running through your body, and you're jerking and twitching, and you know, sometimes it feels like, you know, everything's just turning around inside you. And so that makes it less than ideal as a place to study, to practice Mahamudra from, to study the mind from. But it still can be done. It still can be done, and it's easier than at stage seven. By the time you get to stage nine, then this is a practice that you can just slip into so easily because you have the effortless concentration. You still have a lot of energy, but it's mostly kind of mental energy, and it's helpful to focus that mental energy into some kind of practice. So Mahamudra is really good. As a matter of fact, I recommend to people when they're in stage nine, I recommend to them to do a Mahamudra type of practice as a part of facilitating achieving the goals in that practice. The goal in that practice is to get to where the intensity of the joy and of the energy that's associated with that, to get that to subside. The Mahamudra is a really good practice for helping to bring that about. So, yeah. So that's where it could be practiced in the stage. Now, you could, you know, basically in the entire process of cultivating introspective awareness, and particularly metacognitive introspective awareness, what you're doing is you're developing the essential skills for practicing Maha Mudra. So that when you do practice it, all you need to do is to change the way that attention is working. All the way up to, you know, stage 7, stage 8, you're tending to use attention in a very focused way. And you know, the Maha Mudra, what you want to do is you want that attention basically to expand and kind of work together with awareness. So awareness sees things globally, and you're trying to look at your mind, you look at the activities of your mind, look at objects arising and passing away in your mind. And this is something that only awareness can do effectively. But at the same time, you want to have a kind of penetrating insight and understanding into what it is that you're observing. So that's why you want to bring the analytical capacity of attention, of the part of your brain that does attention kind of thing. You want to bring that into play. And then you're meditating on the nature of mind itself, and it leads to powerful insights. It's designed, you know, the way that there's some meditations that are designed to lead you to insights of impermanence, some that are designed to lead you to insights of the most self. And this is a meditation that's designed specifically to lead you to insight into emptiness.
So since that is the notion is that, so you've got your awareness, is attention moving fast enough to objects that come into awareness to analyze them? Is that sort of the combination of attention and awareness, or is it something more subtle than
that? It's more subtle than that. It's, you know, I have tried to analyze it because I'm trying to describe it to people. It's the best way that I can describe it. It's as though, you know, the scope of your attention can be larger or smaller. And like if you're doing a body scanning practices and experiencing the whole body with the breath, you're practicing using attention with larger and smaller scope. Maha Mudra, it's like you expand the scope of attention till it's as big as the entire field of conscious awareness. That's the best way I can describe it. And the analytical processes aren't taking place consciously. What's happening is, I mean, all the analytical processes in your mind really are taking place unconsciously. And what you see in consciousness is the results of those unconscious processes being projected into consciousness. But the actual analytical processes that operate in attention are happening unconsciously. And so your subjective experience is one of awareness, that is very brilliant awareness, and essentially no experience of focused attention. Actually, the practice, how you get to that place, is that every time you notice attention starting to coalesce around something, you let go of it. And you just keep doing that until finally attention, you know, you open up your scope of your attention, and then something comes into your mind that wants to go like that. And you keep correcting for it every time until finally you have this merging of attention and awareness, and it doesn't do that anymore. And then you're really doing Maha Mudra.
Can you speak, because obviously those practices are considered the pinnacle of those particular paths, but yet now in the West, a lot of times they seem to be presented openly without prerequisites or weekend retreats and so forth. And can you speak a little bit more about why the Samatha background and the ethical component and so forth is necessary in order to benefit from those?
Well, I kind of described that already. You can't really do those practices properly and effectively without the Samatha. You know, and if you...
And without at least stage nine, really, is what you're saying.
That's right. Well, as I say, you can do it at stage seven, but, you know, before that, you're not really going to be able to. And there's very few people in North America that are at that stage. But what the Tibetan lamas seem to be doing is, you know, they're so glad that Westerners want to learn this stuff, they'll teach them anything they ask for. You want to learn Dzogchen? Okay, I'll teach you Dzogchen. You want to learn Mahamudra? I'll teach you Mahamudra. You want to learn Tantra? I'll teach you Tantra. But what they're doing is in total contradiction to the traditional teachings. If you look at the texts on Mahamudra, for example, you know, there's a number of books in English on Mahamudra. They tend to be about that thick, about 2 inches thick. And the first inch or inch and a quarter is Samatha practice before they ever get to even mentioning Mahamudra. And that's the tradition, you know, you do the Samatha first. The same thing with Tantra. You got all kinds of people teaching Tantra to people that don't have any Samatha, but that's not the way it's usually done. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, traditionally you wouldn't even start teaching Tantra until somebody had already basically reached the stage of a stream entrant. But that's not what's happening. I don't know where it's going to lead to. I'm trying to fill the gap, though. Teach people how to develop Samatha.
Did you say our analytical ability is in?
Say what?
Analytical ability.
Yeah.
Is happening unconsciously?
Unconsciously, yeah. What's happening? Is the information what is appearing in consciousness when you're doing the meditation? That information is being assimilated by different parts of your mind that are unconscious, and so then they process it and they try to make sense of it. And essentially, when some part of your mind has made some sense of what it's observing, then it appears in consciousness and you have like an aha experience and an insight.
So when your mind is unified, your analytical ability is still there. They're with you all the way?
Yeah, the analytical abilities are always there. And really there are... They are mostly functioning all the time at an unconscious level. There are certain things, like when you do arithmetic, that's an example of a process that's happening in consciousness, right? And it's very mechanical and it's stepwise, because that's the way things happen in consciousness. In the unconsciously, all these different parts of your mind are functioning simultaneously and independently. And in a sense, it's like each one is working on a different part of the problem. So it's if you know the term serial processing versus parallel processing, you know, serial processing is everything has to go through the processor one step at a time. And that's the way consciousness is. Consciousness is serial. Only one process and taking place at a time, one step at a time. So it's very limited. Whereas in the unconscious, all of these different sub-minds are working simultaneously. And whatever one comes up with can be shared with the others. Eventually that information comes into consciousness. And when it does, it becomes available to all those different sublines at once. But it's like having many different computers working on the same problem at the same time. And especially, I mean, the reason you have all these different sublines is each one has a slightly different function than the others. So that means that when you have all these different unconscious minds working on a problem, they're actually each one working on a different aspect of the problem, because each has its own specialty.
So one time you said in one of the talks, you say everybody's consciousness are the same. It's the same.
Consciousness is the same, but here we're talking about
unconsciousness.
We're talking about consciousness as the subjective experience you have of being conscious of things. So you can think, in that regard, you can think of consciousness. You see, consciousness is one of those words that has a lot of different kinds of meanings. It's not very well defined. As a matter of fact, it's very hard to find a definition of consciousness. And actually, the word is applied to things that are not the same. So when I speak of the conscious mind, you could think of your conscious mind as a place in your mind where all the unconscious parts of your mind exchange information. It's kind of like a bulletin board, you know. One unconscious mind puts some information into consciousness, and when it does, all the other parts of your mind that are also unconscious, they receive that information. So consciousness is a place in your mind where all the unconscious parts of your mind exchange information. And what you experience as consciousness, the only thing you can be conscious of is the information that gets projected into the conscious mind by the unconscious minds. Right? There's, for example, there is an unconscious mind that's total responsibility is auditory information, hearing sounds. Right? But you're not aware of all the sounds. You're only aware of the sounds that unconscious mind in charge of hearing decides is worth projecting into consciousness. And not only that, if other minds are projecting a lot of other information into consciousness, you're having an inner dialogue with yourself about your relationship with your husband or something, then that's occupying most of your consciousness. Not very much auditory information is going to enter into consciousness, because that submind only gets to squeak its information into the cracks. So the subjective experience that you have is you're very conscious of this thing that you're thinking about. And you're just barely conscious of sounds around you.
So when I say unified mind, means all this consciousness will come to
this. This is where all the different parts of your mind start to cooperate and work in harmony. You know, as you notice, sometimes when you've decided to do something, what that means is there's kind of a consensus amongst quite a few unconscious parts of your mind that, yes, that this is a good thing for us to do right now. This is going to make us happy. And then you start to do it, and then all of a sudden some other part of your mind is saying, well, wait a minute, this would be better to do. Right? And maybe some other part of your mind says, no, you're all wrong. This is what's better. We always have this experience of our fragmented mind not really being in harmony. You know, having all these different parts of your mind, their goal is to make the collective, that is you, happy. But they all have totally different ideas about the best way to do that. So they're in conflict with each other. And that's the ununified mind. Most of its energy, most of its power is being wasted because different parts of the mind are trying to go in different directions. You know, it's like if you took a bunch of horses and they're all tied together, but each one's trying to go in a different direction, you know, the whole bunch might move this way for a little bit and then that way for a little bit. It doesn't move very quickly. It doesn't move very fluidly. It's not very powerful. On the other hand, if you've got all the horses going in the same direction at the same time, you've got a powerful team. It moves fast, it moves smooth. That's what you're doing by unifying the mind. You're getting all of these different parts of your mind to basically share common goals and intentions. And then you experience the full power of your mind. And it's amazing to discover how powerful your mind actually is once it's not expending all its energy struggling against itself.
So, how does that work? Well, I mean, a lot of theories, I subject them to what I call the caveman test. I'm not the only one that does this, but...
The caveman test.
Ah. In other words, is this designed good for a caveman?
Yeah.
And this one isn't. Because, you know, the brain is very power hungry. Mm-hmm. And it consumes a large portion of your calories. So cavemen that have non-unified minds that are struggling against each other and not getting very far, I mean, they're going to die. So how does this help the cavemen?
It seems to me like it's perfect... What?
It would be good to have his question.
Okay. the caveman test. How does this... Basically, the question is, why has the mind evolved to function in that way? And the caveman test is to see, okay, if you can see how it makes a caveman more successful in surviving, then you've kind of understood why it's there. And you're saying, you don't see how this unified, how this ununified mind is serving a caveman. Well, let's look at it this way. Unification of the mind is an additional step. What evolved is from very, very simple minds. All these subunits of our mind, you could say, are they're equivalent to the minds of much simpler organisms. So essentially, human beings have evolved to have much more complex minds with many more parts, and each of those parts corresponds to simpler minds.
Sure.
Right? And the advantage of that, of having all these different minds, is that they can be serving different functions simultaneously. You know, it's pretty easy to trick a frog. A lot harder to trick a man. But if we just look at the sensory minds, you have a visual mind, it's responsible for visual information. You have an auditory mind, it's responsible for processing every sound you hear in the environment. You have sub-minds that are responsible for monitoring all the different tactile information coming from your body. Things like whether you're too hot or too cold, or whether there's bugs crawling on you, or whether there's an animal biting your ankle, or, you know, all these different kinds of information. And, of course, taste and smell. Each of those, think of it as a separate unit, is functioning unconsciously. Your auditory mind, the example I used about, is taking in it, all auditory information, and it's processing it, and everything that is irrelevant, it's not dangerous, doesn't seem to be important, it identifies it, and it can safely disregard it. What it's basically doing is looking for anything that might be important. Might be a sound that means you might be able to get something to eat, or a sound that means something may be getting ready to eat you, you know. And that information becomes conscious and gets acted on. All of these different sensory minds are taking care of their own domain of responsibility. And you can see how that passes the caveman test, right?
I'm So far, so good.
Okay. So, well, really, that passes the cave dog test and the cave chicken test, and because basically they're all the same thing. They, you know, the sensory minds, most organs, most organisms have a variety of senses more or less similar to what we do. So really now what we're talking about is another part of the mind we have, other than just processing sensory information. That's the part of your mind that is constantly constructing your worldview, which in turn drives a lot of this stuff. You know, your worldview is really how your auditory mind determines what's important and what's not important.
Right.
And we could call that part of your mind the discriminating mind or the thinking-feeling mind. It's doing a lot more sophisticated kind of information processing that impacts all kinds of things. And it too is divided up into a lot of sub-minds, each with its own functions. Now, this is important for a caveman because all of these different minds are doing their own job to the best of their ability. But remember, they're kind of isolated from each other. They're each functioning autonomously. So it's really great for the caveman to have all these different minds functioning unconsciously, because it gives him all the conscious information that he needs to find berries and catch deer and collect firewood and avoid predators and not get bit by snakes and all kinds of stuff like that. It's just important. Find a mate, you know, find a new cave when he needs one. All of them. Allows him to do all that. But inherent in this is a huge potentiality that is not realized. To the degree that it becomes realized, your caveman can invent agriculture, discover the wheel, invent gunpowder, develop medicine, all kinds of other things. These are the result of the cooperative efforts amongst different parts of the mind. But so our modern man is really different from the caveman, and that's why the cavemen aren't really around anymore, is because they've been totally displaced by human beings that use their inherent mental capacity in a better way. But have we maximized it? Well, it could have been that we have, but the fact of what happens in meditation and the unification of mind and the difference that that makes, the degree of clarity and mental power that can be cultivated by unifying the mind further, that's really, it's not that the ununified mind was ununified in order to serve the needs of a caveman. It's rather that having multiple minds processing information simultaneously was useful for a caveman. And what we're doing is we're in the process of carrying this to the next step.
Well, okay, that doesn't quite get at my question.
Too bad. Okay.
So I understand everything you said about how the mind, the way it works, helps the caveman do all these things at the same time. But the way you said, the way you contrasted the unified mind versus the ununified mind, mm-hmm. it made it sound like the ununified mind is pretty inefficient.
It is.
Okay, and that's what doesn't pass the caveman test. The fact that your average Joe caveman, with an ununified mind, is consuming all these calories and not putting them to the best use. Because caveman 2.0 had a bigger mind, brain, than caveman 1.0,
right.
Because it paid, meaning it made him smarter enough that he could offset that extra calories used in finding more deer and stuff.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel sensible that these brains would be inherently inefficient. It feels more sensible that they would be quite efficient.
Well, they're not as efficient as they could be, is really what we're saying. They're pretty efficient. You know, what I was trying to convey in my explanation is that from the point of view of the needs of a caveman, they're pretty darn efficient. And from the point of view of human beings that have developed the kind of complex technological society that we have, our brains are functioning pretty efficiently. They're meeting the task.
Okay.
We've invented computers. You know, we write books. We do all this kind of stuff. But they are not efficient for a task that has not been particularly pressing before, which is to gain some sort of deeper understanding of the nature of the mind itself, the nature of reality itself, to carry us beyond. You see, okay, let's put it this way. Our not well unified minds are enormously efficient at survival and reproduction. We've overpopulated the planet that we've threatened our own existence. Right? So in a sense, they're too efficient in their main job, what has been their main job up to now. Now, we're fortunate enough to discover that these minds that got us into this pickle have the potential to become more unified and to become more powerful and possibly to find a way out. This is the stage of evolution, you call it spiritual evolution, that now transcends the biological evolution. We got this fabulous brain because it's pretty darn efficient at making us survive. And that was the only thing that was being used for up to now. Now we're going to have to use it to go to the next level. Okay?
I have a question regarding to the utilization of the mind. One of the ways that the mind can be well utilized is know when to remember something, you know, when to forget something. At the right timing, it's really, really important. If we want to meditate, we want to remember, remember the breath,
yeah.
To stay aware, and forget about work, at least for the duration of meditation. It seems like the skill is very, very important. And the strength of the mind can be partly measured by one's ability to remember, at will and forget at will. Say, for example, somebody who's addicted to alcohol or drug, they're always thinking about that fix. And the strength of the mind to overcome that is very important. And the way that I try to achieve these things is through understanding, calculating the benefit and cost and trying to see options and possible outcomes from certain actions. Are there other ways we can strengthen these things other than what I just described, seeing the benefit, seeing the damage, and then choosing not to do something that's harmful, choosing the things that's going to be more beneficial?
Well, that really is the main thing, to be able to see the benefit and see the harm of particular actions. But the seeing can take more than one form. You can think about it. And I'm sure that drug addicts are quite aware, cigarette smokers are quite aware, or alcoholics are quite aware of the harm that is happening to them. But the trouble is that that's only one part of their mind that is aware of that. Cigarette smoker says, I know this is bad for me. Because the part of the mind that knows it's bad for him is basically outweighed by the other parts of the mind that say, oh no, we like to do this, we've always done this, it feels good to do this, it feels bad if we don't do this, and they haven't got the message. So this seeing, this is where the real power of mindfulness comes in. When you observe what's really happening, then there is real information about the benefits and the harm that come from your specific actions. When we're not mindful, somebody says something, and because we've learned to react to what they say in a particular way, maybe we get angry, because maybe when we were younger, getting angry was a good way to deal with certain kinds of situations, right? So we got in the habit of responding to things by getting angry. When you're not mindful, you keep doing the same thing over and over again. Whatever the thing is that makes you angry happens. And that part of your mind that is programmed to make you angry whenever that happens, it kicks in, your mind's flooded with anger, you do and say things. And it creates problems, but instead of really observing the problems, what most people do is they try to ignore it. They try to ignore the harm that they did to themselves and others. Oh, I don't want to see that. So they distract themselves with something else. Go have a drink or something. Or if they don't avoid it and distract, what they do is they set to work rationalizing it. Well, of course I got angry. Everybody get angry. I was justified in getting angry and everything else, you know. Now, that's a normal way of behaving. To be mindful, though, is to observe what's really happening. To observe what you're saying and doing, observe how it's affecting other people, observe how it's actually making you feel. Most people that are prone to anger don't realize how bad getting angry makes them feel. But if they're mindful, then they start realizing that I feel terrible when I get angry. And you hold that in consciousness, and not just for a few moments, but you keep, you know, you notice that 3 hours later, you notice that you still can't do your work as well because your mind's still disturbed by the anger. Maybe your mind's also disturbed because you feel bad about the consequences of what you did because of the anger. Mindfulness, 3 hours later, is saying, see, there's still all kinds of shit happening because of what you did earlier. That's all happening in consciousness. And remember, whatever's in consciousness, every part of your mind, that's information that's available for every part of your mind. If you keep that in consciousness long enough, that part of your mind that's been causing the problem is going to get the message. In the past, such and such happens, it says, oh, time to make us angry, it makes us angry, all the stuff happens, it goes back to sleep, waiting until the next time something like that happens. But now, it's getting this information that, ooh, wait a minute, I thought making us angry was the way to solve the problem and make things better. But it's not, it's making things worse. That part of your mind, that unconscious part of your mind that's been driving that angry behavior, starts to reprogram itself. Because remember, the prime directive for every part of your mind is make us happy. And when it finds out it's not making us happy, then it will change.
You know, there's a lot of the bad habits and addictive behaviors, they share the same pattern. They have very, very quick rewards, and they have a lag, a negative outcome.
That's right.
And then the negative outcome actually makes us feel bad, so we look for the quick reward again. So it's always going in the feedback loop. Like drinking makes me groggy and want to puke, having a headache. I need some more alcohol to make me feel better immediately. Yeah. But then later on, I'll get that headache again. And the same thing applies to food. Same thing applies to almost any kind of adverse behavior, these kind of behavioral patterns. Would you think that is correct, or do you see some exceptions? I'm sure there are exceptions.
Well, there's a whole variety of different kinds of things that lead to us having different kinds of behavior that are not good for us. But yeah, that's one. The negative consequences of drinking and smoking, there's a time lag. So that's one of, I think that's what you were saying. You know, nobody ever gets addicted to touching hot stoves.
Right.
Because, you know, it's right there. But it's a lot easier to, it's a lot easier to eat too much when you're sitting there with all the food and the cheesecake and the chocolates and everything. All you know is that eating more tastes good. You don't feel bad about being overweight or unhealthy or anything else. That's a long way down the road.
Because
Go ahead.
The other day I had similar experience because there's a work function. I don't get to choose what's served at the workplace, and I only have I think 2 slices of pizza. But then it makes me really, really groggy. And then there's still a whole lot of leftover pizzas in the kitchen. I feel really groggy, and my brain couldn't function. I keep trying to breathe in an energetic way, try to revive the mind. And then I'm thinking, oh, there's a lot of pizza. Maybe I should go back, go there and just get some comfort. Yeah. And then I feel like, wow, that is so stupid. This is exactly, I think it's consistent with all of my bad tendencies. Yeah. We do these stupid things because we are not aware.
Think of it like this. There's a part of your mind that said, oh, pizza, wonderful, let's eat a bunch of it. And when you walked away from the pizza and went to the other room, that part of your mind said, okay, done my job. And then later on, you're feeling bad. And that part of me said, oh, we're feeling bad? Oh, a while ago we ate pizza, made it feel good. Let's go eat some more pizza.
I think we just need to know our choices. There are choices like take a cold shower instead of eating more pizza or something.
Well, the purpose of consciousness is to allow these different parts of our mind to exchange information. And if we use consciousness effectively, we make sure we're conscious of the things that are most important to be conscious of. And the thing is, even though anything that's in consciousness, that information is available to every part of your mind, that doesn't mean that the part of your mind that needs that information is awake and paying attention right then. It might not be. So that's why mindfulness is, if you can bring awareness of the problem into consciousness while that part of your mind that's creating the problem is still engaged in paying attention to what's happening in consciousness. To go back to your example, if you're sitting there eating pizza and you realize how bad it made you feel last time, that's the point at which you could maybe, maybe I shouldn't eat so much pizza. It doesn't do any good to have that thought, 2 hours later or an hour later. You need to have that thought when that part of your mind that's responsible for the behavior is paying attention to what's actually happening.
So why are we so bad at turning away from craving when we know, like food is a great example, because everybody knows eat too much, you get heavier. Everybody knows that. There's no secret. There's no secret how many calories are in it. It's all out there. But when there's full knowledge, people will still overeat. I always overeat on the first day of a retreat.
Here's another way to apply here's a different application of your caveman test to this thing, okay? Cavemen didn't have that problem. As a matter of fact, cavemen did best if they ate as much as they could whenever it was available.
Right.
And that's how they got programmed. Right?
Yeah, that's how we operate.
That's how we operate. Now, we live in a world where there's unlimited everything.
But so now, I mean, the craving for that food, we know it makes no sense, but we're very bad at turning away from that.
Yeah.
So how are we going to be good at turning away from other craving and this idea of don't let craving become becoming, right?
Yeah.
Don't let craving become becoming. Well, food is a great example of how we're just no good at that.
Yeah. But it's because the necessary kind of information, if it's not there and if it's not there at the right time, then it doesn't, you know, it doesn't provide the necessary feedback. So if you eat something and you feel really nauseous shortly afterwards, that message is going to get through.
Yeah.
If you eat something and then afterwards you think, oh, this is bad for my arteries, that message is not going to get through to the part of the mind that counts.
So what's the hope for us? If we can't do it with food, why can't we do it with these other things that, you know, what's the path out of this?
Well, the thing is that we can't do it, we can't really do it with much of anything just through
willpower.
Logic and intellectual understanding. And willpower is where one part of your mind is trying to force other parts of your mind, and it just doesn't work.
Right.
You know, one part of your mind can't impose its will on the rest of your mind. Or if it can only succeed in doing it for a short time. And those other parts of the mind that have been repressed, they're waiting for their opportunity. And when it comes up.
Well, I'm responding to what you said one or two nights ago. You said something like, you know, craving turns into becoming, and if you just don't do that action, then the craving weakens.
Yeah.
You know, so just don't do it. Just don't do it. The craving weakens. But how are we going to not do it? How's that going to happen?
But we can do that. It's not easy. I mean, you know, it's really, really hard for people to quit smoking, for example. Yet, I bet you know and have heard of people that once they found out that they had emphysema or lung cancer or something like that, they didn't smoke another cigarette. Of course, there's always a few people, you know. I used to notice the people with the oxygen tanks in the wheelchair sitting outside the VA hospital smoking cigarettes. There's always a few like that. But, you know, everybody that smokes knows it's not good for them, but they can't bring themselves to quit until, usually when somebody quits, it's a number of different kinds of information get through in a way that, the way I would describe it, that there's enough different parts of their mind that have now come to the same conclusion and have a consensus that essentially they outnumber and outvote the parts of their mind that want to keep doing the unhealthy thing.
I think if you find something more interesting, your attention will be shifted.
Well, that's another important strategy dealing with your mind, is that every part of your mind wants you to be happy. So if you just quit drinking and now you're unhappy, doesn't work very well. Whereas if you go to an AA meeting and you feel a lot of mutual support and camaraderie and everything like that, it's a lot easier not to drink. If you're trying to quit smoking and you find some activity to do that's entertaining and distracting and keeps you busy and makes you happy, it's easier not to have a cigarette. So if you understand how your mind works and you want to change your behavior, accentuate the positive. If you want to become good at meditation, try to always be aware of the pleasurable aspect of the meditation. You're sitting here and, really quiet. My body feels good. If you stay on the breath for 10 breaths and you realize, this is really, really pleasant. This is nice. And you keep that awareness. Then your meditations will become easier and easier. On the other hand, if you're sitting here trying to meditate, but you keep thinking about something else that you could be doing, and geez, one thing I hate about meditating is that my knees and ankles always hurt after I've been sitting for 15 minutes. And if your mind's just dwelling on the negative, if you're at another negative, you're meditating and say, gee, I've been doing this for the same amount of time as Joe, but he's such a better meditator than I am. That's a negative. That's going to turn you off to meditate. And you have expectations and you experience disappointment. Oh, I'm not doing this well. So meditation is a good example. If you can learn to succeed in meditation, then hopefully in the process, you'll also realize the things that you did that made you successful is that you accentuated the positive, and that essentially you gradually brought around the different parts of your mind that thought that watching TV would be a better way to spend your time than meditating. You brought them around to the idea that, well, actually, maybe meditation is the best thing to be doing right now. Until, as there are more and more parts of your mind that get on board with your goal to meditate, meditation gets easier and you get to be better at it, and there's fewer parts of your mind saying, no, we should have a daydream instead. Okay? So if you come to realize how it is that you go about becoming good at meditation, then you can apply exactly the same thing to following precepts, making good karma instead of bad karma, all of these other things. Is what's the good side? Be aware of the good side. Be mindful of the good side of doing the right thing, and be fully aware and mindful of the downside of doing the wrong thing. And that doesn't mean analytically thinking that, you know, smoking cigarettes is not good for my lungs. It's things like, actually, this doesn't feel that good. Right? Or going, and saying, you know, I'm tired of it. So
some of these addictions, though, are really short-term in a sense. 100 years ago, who smoked cigarettes? I mean, the invention of the cigarette that we smoke today is relatively new. Same thing with the food we're consuming in the United States.
That's right. Yeah.
It's laced a lot with sugar, high fructose corn syrups, which are physically addicting, not mentally, but physically. So it's like the cards are stacked against us as Americans. Because elsewhere around the world, obesity and diabetes is not like here.
All the people in the world that make money off of manufacturing food and sell it are extremely aware that the more fat and sugar and salt that they put in the food, the more people will eat.
Yeah.
And the more they'll buy, the more money they'll make.
McDonald's sizes compared to 40 years ago.
That's right.
So it's, but I think it's temporary. And like what you're talking about, we're just becoming aware of it.
Well,
we've got a lot of fat, sick people, and it's just a matter of time.
Right. How is it going to change? Well, I guarantee you that as long as people keep buying the food with lots of fat, sugar, and salt, the people that make it are not going to stop making it.
Right.
It's only if there are enough people out there who refuse to buy it because, for whatever reason or another, they've overcome their craving for it. When that happens, then the people who are interested in making money will change what they do. And that's what you see. The only reason that you can buy organic produce right now is because there were enough people who wanted it and who didn't want the other stuff.
Yeah.
And so somebody said, oh, I can make money from it. Now you can buy it. Yes?
I think one problem people still doing the humble things is because they puddle their mind thinking to take a chance. Like, for example, say, I eat this, I won't die right away.
Right.
I do this just this time.
That's
know?
Right.
So it's hard to quit, even though you know it's harmful.
Right. Yeah. That's true. There's the short-term pleasure versus, I mean, the average person doesn't believe that they'll die. And the average person doesn't believe that the bad thing's going to happen to them. and that works against them. That allows that part of your mind that's seeking short-term gratification to outvote the part of your mind that knows it's not wise.
The thing is, I think everybody believes that they will win the lottery. That's why everybody buys it. Yeah, everybody believes that they're special.
Yeah.
And they won't die.
That's
car accidents won't happen to them. They can drink and drive and nothing bad will happen.
There are a lot of people that actually know what the odds of winning the lottery are, that still spend a very large amount of money every month, perhaps more than they can afford, buying lottery tickets. You know, now, there's some people who don't know. Some people who don't know, they just have this vague idea that, yeah, I know the chances are against me, but as you say, they believe that they're going to win. But what is really amazing are the people that know. They know exactly what the odds are. They know that they are more likely to get struck by lightning than they are to win the lottery. But they'll still buy $100 worth of tickets every month. And not only that, the same person will get to the place where they can't quite afford to pay their mortgage. So instead of saving $100 by not buying lottery tickets, they'll buy $200 worth.
Maybe the question I should have asked before was, since people in general are not good at turning away from craving, what is it about this path that makes people better at that, that then they are able to, you know, not do the action, therefore weakening craving, and do it again and again? What is it about this path that makes it more likely that someone is able to?
Well, the way this path works is that once you have an intellectual understanding, and if you don't have the intellectual understanding, it's much harder. Although you could, if you're somebody that just responds really well from some authoritative person saying this is what you should do, but if you have an intellectual understanding of the Dharma, then you can begin in small ways to weaken craving, to decrease the number of occasions in which you act out of craving, to practice mindfulness so that you have more and more direct experience of the benefits of not acting out of craving and the harm that comes from acting out of craving. These are all helpful things, but they are not, you will not succeed on the path on the basis of these things. You'll become somewhat better. But ultimately, the only thing that's going to make a difference is to have insight experiences that change the way your mind operates. You know? It's like the person diagnosed with lung cancer, they have an insight experience that they really are going to die. If they don't quit smoking, and then all of a sudden it becomes easy. As we have insight experiences you have a lot of insight experiences when you meditate that are not in the supramundane category, and they all help. Every time you have an experience where you realize, yeah, this Dharma is true. Whenever you have an experience that says, oh yeah, greed is causing me problems, and greed makes me unhappy, and so on and so forth. Or every time you have an experience that says that aversion and anger is causing me a problem, it leads to insight that makes it easier for you to follow this path. And that's why there's 8 parts to this path. Right understanding by itself only gets you so far. But practicing all the other parts, they all reinforce each other. If you are practicing mindfulness, you have insights. If you're practicing meditation, your mindfulness becomes more powerful and you have more insights. And the more insight you have, every time you have an insight, some part of your mind is reprogramming itself on the basis of this insight. And that's what makes the difference. Your automatic, intuitive reactions and behaviors, they're originating in these unconscious parts of your mind. It's not till the unconscious parts of your mind get reprogrammed that you can really make headway towards changing your external behavior. But it all works together. Practicing the precepts is a good example. If you only practice the precepts in the sense of it's like the Ten Commandments, or it's like a set of rules, it's like a law, don't do this, don't do that, you'll have limited success. And it won't make any big changes in you. But if you practice the precepts as a practice, meaning that you examine and reflect on your behavior and the consequences of your behavior and so on and so forth, that changes something deep inside you. And then it becomes easier and easier. So,
What about, what role do you feel that the things like the contemplation of the four thoughts that change the mind, or the five things that should be frequently reflected, those kind of contemplations of death, impermanence, and karma, the discursive meditation in daily life, do you feel that that's a valuable practice for us to be doing?
They are, but only to a certain limited degree. Because as long as they remain discursive, then, you know, you still have this vulnerability. Because that deep unconscious part of your mind that's driving the behavior that goes counter to this practice, it's much more powerful than the part of your mind that is functioning at this discursive intellectual level. Like I said earlier, if you carefully examine human beings, and actually if you examine yourself, you realize that nobody really believes they're going to die. At least not until something happens and they're really confronting it. But absolutely everybody knows intellectually that they're going to die. Everybody knows that intellectually.
So we don't commit suicide. We don't always think about death and, you know, being morbid. I'm sorry.
But then something can happen in your life, and you can realize that for sure you are going to die, and you're really lucky that you didn't, and then your behavior changes from then on. You don't go through life with this attitude that, Young people especially. Young people do all kinds of really crazy, foolhardy things. It's amazing that they survive as well as they do. We were all young people at one time. And we all did things that we can look back at and say, oh my God, I'm so lucky that, you know, that could have gone so bad. But we have experiences that change these deep internal views that we have, and that's how we make progress.
Those things you learn in your lifetime, again, but they don't sit in your karma.
What's that? They don't.
The knowledge you learn through your age, but they are not safe in your karma.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of where there's a lot of things that you can learn up here that make absolutely no difference to your karma. It's what you need to change is your karma. So, if you've got the karma to eat too much, that's what you've got to do is change your karma. Doesn't matter to know that it's not good for you and you need to change. That doesn't make any difference. You could even spend a lot of money to go to some diet place and they're happy to take your money, but after you've lost your 20 pounds and gone home again, you gain it right back because the behavior hasn't, your karma hasn't changed.
You're actually in peace with, I'm sorry.
So karma has set the intention, you know, you said one time, karma, set the intention. How about your dislike, your like? with leaves, are they safe in the culture?
Yeah. Well, your likes and dislikes, and that's a very important thing to recognize, is that there is pleasure and pain, and then there is the mind's reaction to pleasure and pain, right? And basically the things that are painful and the things that are pleasurable are not going to change. And a Buddha, anybody feel, continues to feel unpleasant sensations and pleasant sensations, pleasure and displeasure. That doesn't change. But your mind's reaction to the pleasant and the unpleasant can change. Now, likes and dislikes. Now, that's okay. You can eat something and it can taste good. And so as a result of it, you come to like that thing. Right? So now you've got you've got not only the pleasant taste, but you've got the mind's pleasant reaction. You know, whenever you see that thing or smell that thing or think about that thing, it produces this this pleasant reaction that reinforces the desire that, you know, okay, I'll have that. That can change. I mean, everybody's had that experience. There's things that you once liked that you no longer like. It can change for many reasons. You could eat something that you really like and then get really sick afterwards, and from then on you don't like it anymore. Sometimes that's all it takes. Or sometimes what happens is that for some reason or another, you don't eat that thing for a very long time. And that conditioning of your mind has changed so that you eat it again and you say, why did I used to think this was so great? There's a lot of things that can change. But your likes and dislikes, there's an aspect of your likes and dislikes that you can't do much about. Sugar is always going to taste sweet, right? But there's another aspect to your likes and dislikes that can be changed. If you eat too much sugar, you get to the point where you don't like it as much, right?
Those things go with your karma too?
They're all karma.
All karma.
Karma is basically how we condition ourselves. So all of those things are karma.
So no knowledge, though.
It's not. It's a different kind of knowledge. It's a deep unconscious knowledge. There was a time in my life when I used to smoke cigarettes, and I thought it was really pleasant and it tasted good. And so I quit smoking, and I said to myself, okay, I'll quit smoking, that's fine. But when I'm 95, I'm going to start again. Because it was a pleasant thing to do, and I liked it. And then after I had been smoking for a few years, I cannot imagine. It doesn't feel good, it doesn't taste good, it doesn't smell good. And when I'm 95, I won't smoke. But that's when you're talking about karma, you're talking about changes at that kind of deep level. And it's all about desire and aversion, and it's all about ignorance. And you overcome ignorance through wisdom. And wisdom isn't just intellectual understanding. Real wisdom is wisdom that's acquired through direct experience. That's real wisdom. So wisdom counteracts ignorance. And you overcome craving, desire, and aversion partly through achieving wisdom and partly through using your wisdom to change your behaviors. That's how you change your karma. Bad karma is ignorance, desire, and aversion. Good karma are the opposites of those three. And so really, in a sense, it's that simple. But all the different strategies for how you change your karma, that's where it gets a little more complicated. But that's the whole idea of this path, of the Eightfold Path, is it gives you a whole variety of tools to change your karma. Yes?
John, I remember you also hold a class to guide people get into jhana, right?
Yes.
I'm wondering, the benefit of meditation practice, are we able to experience it during this retreat?
Does the jhana benefit in meditation practice?
No, I mean, you hold a class.
Yeah.
Just to help people to get into jhana status.
Yeah.
You say something like people had to be probably at around like step 4, step 6.
Oh, step 6,
like,
yeah. Stage 6.
I'm wondering, that kind of experience, does it help? Does it benefit of meditation practice?
It's very beneficial in two ways. Uh-huh. One is that practicing jhana improves the quality of your samatha. So if you start practicing a very light jhana, the only jhana you can do at stage 6 is a very light jhana. But if you practice that jhana, you will advance to stage 7 and 8 and so forth more easily. So that's one way it helps. And the same thing, if you practice a deeper jhana at stage 7, it will speed up your practice. You practice jhanas that involve seeing a light as a nimitta when you get to stage 8 or stage 9, then that jhanas always accelerate your practice because the mind is entering into a state that is very similar to what you're trying to achieve. And so you're conditioning the mind. So it's very beneficial in that way. The second benefit of jhanas is, and this is really the reason the Buddha taught jhanas, is jhanas produce insight. If you use the jhanas properly, the jhanas need to be practiced with powerful introspective awareness. As a matter of fact, they're only real jhanas if they're only real Buddhist jhanas if there is powerful introspective awareness. Which means that practicing the jhana allows you to understand the nature of the mind. Going through first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, the formless jhanas. This is like peeling away the onion of the mind, seeing the different layers, levels of your mind.
Excuse me, let me interrupt. Do you have Chinese word for jhana?
Chana.
Chana.
Has anybody here attended the class of jhana?
Did you?
No.
Okay. So you're the only one here that would have attended that, but you didn't. Have to do it again.
I don't think so.
Who are qualified? I mean, what students are qualified to attend that jhana class?
Well, I gave that class to anybody that wanted to come, and a number of the people that attended that class have since become quite good at practicing jhana. But you know, those whose meditation practice was still in a very early stage didn't have as much success, but they learned a lot of useful things to them.
How many days is that program? How many days?
That was a 3-day weekend.
3 days. That's really good.
What I would really like to do, one of my long-term goals, is to have meditation retreats that are geared to specific levels. So, you know, I'd love to do a meditation retreat for people that are at stage 6 and 7 and 8, and I would teach the jhanas as a part of that retreat. So, most of the time, though, I always have this mixture of people that have just begun meditating and other people that are meditating for the first time in 20 years and other people that have been meditating 2 hours a day for the last 10 years. And so it's such a mix, it's really hard to teach these kinds of things.